Good evening and welcome to our event with Mary Roach, celebrated author. We're broadcasting live from Salt Lake City's main public library, and we're thrilled to partner with Weller Bookworks and the Salt Lake City Library. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. I'm editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thrilled to see a full capacity house here tonight to support this kind of great programming. I want to thank the community just for your tremendous support over the past year. It has been a roller coaster, and it was topped by us winning the Pulitzer Prize in the spring. Thank you. We are going to be unveiling a new website in a matter of weeks, so please stay tuned for that. We are just so grateful to this community for standing with us through thick and thin, and I mean thick and thin. I assure you, we are not an enemy of the people, as someone has suggested. It is my great privilege tonight to introduce our guide for the evening, Tribune reporter extraordinaire, our resident intellectual, Ellen Fagg Wiest. On with the show.
Thank you. And Mike, yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. I'm used to being in those seats, so let me just tell you, you all look beautiful from up here. My name is Ellen Wiest of the Salt Lake Tribune, and I have to begin by saying how much we appreciate being in a room of readers, and particularly of curious readers. And I'm making a lot of assumptions about you tonight, which as journalists we don't like to do very often, but I'm making those assumptions because you've turned out to have a conversation with Mary Roach. So I'm very grateful to see you, and I'd like to invite Mary to the stage now.
She's back there. Yeah.
Mary is here, of course, traveling to promote her latest book called Grunt, about the curiosities of military research. In our conversation tonight, I'm hoping all of us can feel like we're embedded with the military, at least with the science of military. And I'm hoping that we can hear more about the stories that made it into her pages, and also maybe a little bit more about the stories that didn't. And that's a great way to introduce Mary's work and to talk a little bit about maggots. Maybe some of you have read Mary's work and know about maggots, but let me just say that many of us, perhaps all of us in this room, if we were to hear the word maggots at the dinner table, we might be a little bit, grossed out. In Mary Roach's world, the chance to see the insect's mouth parts, or as she calls them, the showpiece of maggot anatomy, to see those under a microscope on a kitchen table causes her to wax enthusiastically and to create a particularly memorable character in the real-life passions of scientist George Peck, the resident filth fly expert. I love that. I'm going to say that again. The resident filth fly expert at the entomology branch of the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. Roach describes the maggot that Peck shows her, again, at the dinner table, as something kind of adorable. Here's her description. I'm going to read your words aloud to you.
All right.
That's okay.
Yes.
They are less off-putting than you might imagine, she writes. Straight out of the vial, they're the size of cupcake sprinkles. When they're not eating each other alive, they're kind of adorable. They move like inchworms, like something you might see humping along the pages of a children's book. If you haven't read Grunt yet, that's on page 176, just if you want to follow along. This is science writing, Mary Roach style. Her books reveal a curious mind and a quirky eye, and she has built a career out of following her curiosity. Over the course of 6 best-selling books, she's created her own nonfiction niche, defined by quirky sensibility and, as someone once wrote, her zingy footnotes. And I mention those because I personally like knowing that the Medicare reimbursement code for maggots, and it's listed in her book, and again, it's on page 176. If you want to look at the footnotes, then you too can have the Medicare reimbursement code for maggots. So in all of the reviews about Mary's book, they like to point out the headline-grabbing stuff. I wrote a little bit about that in Sunday's newspaper article previewing tonight, and headline-grabbing stuff includes talking her husband into a free trip to Europe, all in order that they could couple while hooked up to an ultrasound machine. And I'm pointing out that it wasn't an MRI machine, it was an ultrasound.
Thank you, yes.
Yeah. And then there's my favorite, where she chose to forego sedation drugs during her own colonoscopy. So I thought all of that is a great background to those of you who might not have read every word of her six books, but also I thought that would start us on our conversation tonight. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit in front of you as if we're having a conversation intimately in this room. And then we will accept questions. And then I'm hoping that we can end up with all of us suggesting topics for Mary's next book. You know, you heard Kat earlier talk about how much Salt Lake wants to be on the hardcover book tour. I thought the best way we could do that is if we suggest the topic that would give Mary her next subject matter. So we have a little incentive here to produce some good ideas. So with that, we'll go ahead into our Q&A now. And so what I wanted to start with, Mary, is what made you know that there was a book in Grunt? Where were you in your research when you knew that this was really possible?
Well, Grunt is a book that grew out of a trip that had nothing to do with military science. I was reporting in India on the world's hottest chili pepper.
Of course.
There's this unbelievable chili pepper eating contest there, because this is the hottest chili pepper in the world, and there's a competition to eat the most, to actually swallow and chew, and people are being taken away in ambulances. It's just unbelievable. But anyway, that's another night. But while I was there, somebody said, you know, this pepper, the Indian Defense Ministry they weaponized it. They made a non-lethal weapon, a sort of like a pepper spray, but sustainably locally grown pepper bomb. It was actually a bomb that would, it would explode pepper. And I went to this lab to see that. And in fact, they never deployed the pepper bomb. It was prone to mildew. So it got shelved. But anyway, while I was there, I'd never been to any kind of military science facility. They were working on a leech repellent, which just was like, you're what? And they were going down to the river and rolling up their trousers and trying different compounds for making a leech repellent for troops. And I remember thinking that military science was kind of a little more esoteric than I thought, and really my kind of strange world to step into. And there's a lot of writing about the military, but it tends to be, you know, memoirs or very, very thorough histories of battles. There's all this stuff that out there in the realm of science that kind of falls through the cracks. And so that's my stuff. I'm the bottom feeder of nonfiction. That stuff no one else writes about, I'll do that.
What does that make us as your readers? If you're the bottom. How did you overcome the problem of access? You were talking a little bit to me on the phone about the access to military bases and military research.
Yeah, the access I assumed would be highly problematic because of my experience with NASA for packing for Mars. It was a little tough. The public affairs people tended to have a lot of rules, and I would, I'd be calling up and going, I have a chapter on restricted hygiene, and I wondered if when the shuttle lands, could I smell it right when it lands? and they're like, no, you can't sniff the shuttle. No, God. And at a certain point, they just stopped returning emails, like halfway through the book. Just, and there's a lot of public affairs people like, well, I'll try this one. Well, I'll try this one. There was just somebody must have sent around a memo that said, just ignore her and maybe she'll go away. So I thought that the military would be like that times 10. But in fact, they were actually really helpful. And because of the NASA experience, I started at the top. I'm like, I'm going to the Pentagon. And if I can get, like, if they're okay with it, then everybody else has to be okay with it. And in fact, the Secretary of Defense, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, has a public affairs for books person. And you can write a little kind of a very sketchy proposal, and you get just saying, this is what I'd like to do, and here's what might be in the book. And at that point, of course, I have no idea what will be in the book. And then they will send you a letter of support if they support you. And it doesn't mean they'll make anybody talk to you. It doesn't mean they'll do anything else for you, but you have this little letter, and you can show it to people, and then they don't worry so much about getting in trouble. Mm-hmm. And the little, it turns out not actually to be a letter, but just like a two-line email. Like, so I could have deleted not. Like, we do not support this. But in fact, it said we support the vote. I didn't really, I used it a few times and it did seem to help, but I think it was really hardly necessary. The hardest thing was finding, it wasn't people saying no, it was finding the person who was authorized to say yes. You know, and my requests would be a little unusual. Like, I remember trying to contact this woman at the Naval Medical Research Center. I wanted to go to Djibouti, where there's a base where a lot of special operations folks leave to Yemen, Somalia, et cetera. And I wanted to go with a diarrhea researcher.
We'll
come back to diarrhea. But anyway, with me, it always comes back to crap. So she's like, and I probably said infectious gastrointestinal disease. I probably didn't say diarrhea. I'm doing a diarrhea chapter. No, I probably sounded far more intelligent and serious. But anyway, it was a lot of just, she just said, I haven't a clue who we ask. Is it AFRICOM, CENTCOM, the Pentagon, and et cetera. And so a lot of emails went back and forth. And that happened a lot. It took over a year to get on to the ballistic missile submarine. And in the end, that was just one guy named Jerry Lamb who said, you know, I'm retiring in a year, and I like your books, and we always say no, and I don't give a damn. So we're going to make this happen.
Well, let's go to the ballistic submarine, because it took a long time to get access. Some of it was because of scheduling was so hard. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then where were you when the submarine was actually doing a test?
Yeah, it was, those submarines, I mean, they contain a big chunk of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. There's, I forget how many Trident missiles on there, and the whole idea is that they go out for months and months, they stay down, they have a nuclear reactor, so they don't need to come up for gas. they just stay down, and they're, nobody knows where they are except the people who know where they are. And so I wanted to go out on one, and they're not gonna take me aboard for 3 months, and I didn't wanna be aboard for 3 months. So that was the challenge, and we had to find a short, way to get on, and there were no short trips, but finally what happened, there was a group of prospective commanding officers, and they were doing a practical exam out at sea where they were going to throw everything at them, including launch all missiles, which was really surreal. So I went out with them. We went out on a ship, about 8 hours out on the Atlantic. I don't know where. They didn't blindfold me, but they might as well have because we were just in the middle of nowhere. And in the morning, we stop, and a submarine just pops up. And they put kind of a gangplank down between the boat and the sub, and the six of us, the prospective commanding officers and me, just climbed down the ladder, and the sub went down, and off it went. And it was a four-day exam, so it was perfect, so they were able to, I was able to stay for 4 days and then come back to shore. But it took over a year, to figure out how to
It took over a year, and that chapter was about sleep deprivation.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. And so getting out there caused more sleep deprivation.
Yes, exactly. Getting out there. I've slept pretty well.
Not for you.
No, not for me. But yeah, people often ask about the challenges of writing my books, and really it's figuring those things out, and I would just wear people down to a stub. I'm just, like poor Jerry Lamb, like every other week I'd be, hi, it's me again, just checking in.
Well, and one of the fascinating things about that chapter is that it's hard to find a quiet space to sleep, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
So tell about right. the most interesting place to sleep on that.
Yeah, this was just talking about surreal. The whole center of a submarine. Basically, when they made ballistic subs, they took a regular sub and kind of like cut it in half and stuck this large compartment in the middle with a bunch of Trident missile silos, which are about half the stage, and so you could fit maybe two of them on here. And there's some space in between. And it turns out the space in between the nuclear missiles, the warheads, is just right for a little a little sleeping pad. So the lucky sailors uh-huh. get a little privacy by sleeping amid the Trident missiles, which is really amazing. I would have slept. But they had gone to such great lengths to evict these poor guys from the. There were a few bunks. It was myself, and there were two women from CENTCOM who were there. So
one of the interesting things about that chapter is how much the Navy has to deal with sleep deprivation in terms of schedules and
yeah.
all of that.
Well, submarines in particular, because somebody, going way, way back, when scientists first figured out circadian rhythm, the human body, the temperature, and sleepiness cycle throughout the day. They also discovered that it's linked to sunlight, that sunlight facilitates that. So there was this idea, submarine crews, there's no sunlight down there. We can make up our own day. We can just make it however works for the schedules. So they have a shorter day that kind of worked out better for splitting up the watches. And it took a long time before they realized that in fact, the body still wants to be on a 24-hour cycle. It doesn't, even if there's no sun. So in essence, in addition to being incredibly sleep deprived because they have way too much to do now that submarines are nuclear and there's just more to be watched than there used to be. So in addition to being sleep deprived, they're jet lagged. So sleep has been made something of a priority. But there's been a lot of resistance. The sailors and submariners are like, this is always the way we've done it. Yeah. And it's also a badge of honor to be sleep deprived. Like, yeah, I had 2 hours last night. What about you? Yeah.
Well, it's a little frightening that the sailors who are in charge of our nuclear weapons are sleep deprived.
That
was new to me from reading
Yeah,
the book.
No, there was. I remember I was down in this section of the sub where there was the oxygen generator, which kind of splits apart water molecules, and I don't know exactly how it works. And I asked him, so what does it do? It splits apart water and makes oxygen wet. And he goes, yeah, it's basically like a hydrogen bomb. And I'm like, and at the same breath, he'd basically been up all night because it wasn't working right. And I was up all night last night. He's got parts all over the floor. I'm like, so maybe sleep is important.
Yeah. I'd like to hear a little bit more. You've been talking about Grunt on the Road now for a year. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about, after a year, who are some of the characters in the book that really stand out to you? I mean, I personally love the maggot guy, George Peck.
Peck was, here's a guy who, he's so misunderstood over in the military entomology department because most of the pie goes to malaria, working on a malaria vaccine or treatment. Filth flies, they're a tiny segment of it. And maggot debridement therapy, that's what he was looking at. Because maggots, in fact, if a wound that's infested with maggots seems hideous, disgusting, and dangerous, but in fact, maggots are your friend because they prefer dead tissue. That's their menu item of choice, is dead tissue. So they do debridement, which is what surgeons will do. If you have a lot of dirt in a wound and you need and a lot of infected and dead tissue, they'll clean it out surgically. But the maggot will very precisely go in and do that, and so much so that it is, as you referenced earlier, it's actually an FDA approved medical device. The maggot, yeah. Live maggots are. So George Peck was trying to, mostly maggot debridement therapy is used with diabetics or people with, ulcers that are hard to heal in the skin. And he was suggesting, why don't we bring this back with some of these IED wounds, because there's a lot of, when the blast goes off and it's a buried bomb, it's accelerating all of this debris and sand and bacteria deep into the wound, and it's really hard to keep them clean, and the infections keep recurring. And so he was pushing for that. And of course, you know, people are like, maggots? You're going to bring maggots into a hospital? And, you know, he's like the lonely crusader for maggots. And just had also this just love and respect for these little kind of vile creatures, but not really vile. Because the little ones are, as I said, they're very cute.
Cupcake sprinkles.
But he had me over for dinner, he and his wife, and it was this sort of Norman Rockwell tableau. You know, his wife and he were setting the table, the children were doing homework in the living room, and we sat and had wine and dinner. And then afterwards, George comes up with this little cut glass bowl that looks like chocolate pudding, because it is time for dessert. But in fact, he said, I've raised you a clutch of maggots. A clutch. I've raised you. And he set them down, and, you know, they were really just, you know, it was packed with maggots. It was, but it's all context, because in the context of his kitchen table and with his enthusiasm, it wasn't the horribly disgusting sight that ordinarily it would be.
Yeah. And it was the dessert course.
And so, it was the dessert course, yes.
Yeah. So George Peck, are there other characters?
Oh, yeah, George Peck was great. I have to say I was a big fan of, getting back to diarrhea. My goal for myself in going to Djibouti, to Camp Lemonnier, is I didn't just want to interview the researcher. He was doing clinical trials of a faster treatment for diarrhea, you know, for certain bacterial infections. But what I really wanted to talk to some Navy SEALs or the other special operations people who are there, because they get diarrhea far more than anyone else. Most of the food and water on a base is safe. You don't get sick on a base. It's very hygienic. But when you, as a Navy SEAL or someone, go out into the villages of Yemen or Somalia in this case, and you're eating with the locals and you're drinking water that might not have been treated or filtered, they get diarrhea. They get it all the time. And you can imagine if your mission is to like go in and take out Osama bin Laden, and whatever your mission as a special operator is, you don't really have the option to go, I don't feel so good. So I needed to have a conversation. And that's kind of an awkward, these guys are sort of imposing, and they kept to themselves. They were in a classified section, special zone, with, you know, razor wire and, you know, signs that said, we are authorized to shoot to kill if you try to come in here with your notebook, you idiot. So
that's the official military issue sign.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So the public affairs guy said, you know, Mary, I don't know what to tell you. They only come out to eat and to steal our women. So I had to come up to, the, I had to like find a guy. It was pretty easy because they've got beards and they're really buff during dinner. So I had to come, you know, to approach one of these fairly imposing individuals while he's sitting by himself eating dinner, and then somehow explain myself that I want to talk about diarrhea, and also while he's eating, was, I think, probably the most awkward reporting challenge of my career. So I dragged the public affairs guy with me, and I said, you have to introduce me. And he did try to do that. He said, excuse me, sir, may I? Because we had to ascertain that this guy was special operations, because they don't, you know, wear a shirt that says, I'm a big macho special operations dude.
Yeah.
So we assumed that he was, but he couldn't know that we had assumed that. And so the public affairs guy said, excuse me, may I ask you what line of work you're in? And this guy goes, I'm done, I'm leaving, and he goes to get up. And then I had to jump in, and I had to go, oh, yeah, well, if you could just, you know, I'm an author, and I'm here working on a chapter. It has to do with diarrhea, and I know that sounds really kind of, it's a silly topic. And he looked up and said, it's not. You're welcome to sit down. So, and he was really forthcoming. I mean, he couldn't tell me anything about the missions. He couldn't give me any details, but he could give me the details about what that's like, you know? I think the memorable, oh, no, I can't say it. That's on radio.
I don't think you can.
Anyway, it's in the book.
And then
Since we've already covered diarrhea, I thought we could go to the It Could Get Weird chapter. Do you want to talk a little bit about genital transplants and why do readers ask about this chapter so much? And also, what should we know about the military's interest in this research specifically?
Oh, sure. Penis transplants and also penis reconstruction have become a matter of growing importance in the military medical circles for a couple of reasons. When you're a soldier and you step on something explosive, it used to be it was a landmine, and maybe you'd lose your leg to here or something along those lines, or your foot. But the two things have happened. The bombs are much bigger. They're much bigger. They're big enough so that the damage is going all the way up to your pelvic region sometimes. The other thing that's happening is that the medevacs are faster and the emergency care is better. And there's better access to blood. And so people who would have died from such a huge exposure to such a huge explosion are living to need repair work. And so now there's just a lot more work for the urological surgeons at Walter Reed. And one of the things, I witnessed reconstruction of a urethra while I was at Walter Reed on a patient who had, in fact, stepped on an IED. And while I was there, I was talking to the surgeon, and I said, what other things in terms of advancements and new developments are there on the horizon? And he said, well, they're doing some work over at Johns Hopkins. They're doing a cadaver study of a penis transplant. And of course, I'm like, oh, excuse me.
Dead bodies.
Did you say cadaver? Do you have the name of that person?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was, anyway, it was fascinating. It was a what they call a, instead of a dry run, it was a wet run. So it was a really interesting morning. And they were looking at, obviously, it was an interesting morning. They were looking at, they weren't doing the entire process, but they were trying to figure out which blood vessels, which arteries were the important ones to hook up. So they do this interesting thing where they've got it's a dyed blue solution in an IV bag that then go and they can hook it up to an artery and see, the skin kind of looks like a speeded up bruise forming. And you can see, this is important because this whole area is being perfused. And so they were doing that, and that was fascinating. And it wasn't at a military hospital, but the Defense Department had funded some of the work. Yeah.
So to give all of you here and all of the listeners, some backstory here, tell me where you wanted to put that in the book.
I led right with that cadaver penis transplant scene, and my editor, bless her heart, said, Mary, we're not leading with the cadaver penis thing. We're not sending people straight, many of whom are men, we're not sending them straight into the penis transplant section. No.
So you've heard it here now. You've got some backstory that, most readers wouldn't have.
My poor editor, yeah.
So let's just back up a little bit. Tell us a little bit about how you got into this line of work. Tell us all about your science fairs and everything you did growing up to prepare you to become a science writer.
Yeah, nothing, absolutely nothing. Although when I was a kid, I do have this memory. I mean, I wasn't a science geek in high school at all. I took the easier science classes. I liked my physics class very much because I had a crush on the teacher. I think that was what was going on here, let's be honest. But I didn't take the honors science classes, and I didn't take science classes in college. But when I was a kid, I had kind of a fascination for how science was done, for field research. Because I have this memory of with my fifth grade neighbor, Becky Balch, we did something called the potted meat experiments. And we potted meat, what? Yeah,
yeah.
Potted meat. We made little potted meat sandwiches, and we went up into the woods, we hung one from a tree, we buried one in the snow, and we didn't have a hypothesis. We didn't collect any data. We just sort of went around with a clipboard and like looked for tracks in the snow, or I don't know. Yeah. It all started with the potted meat experiments. Yeah.
Too bad we can't segue right into maggots, but we'll move on from there about potted meat. So how did you get started? And what was it about working in PR for the San Francisco Zoo that got you started in terms of writing?
I was the public affairs assistant at the San Francisco Zoological Society when I first got out of college, and which really suited me. I was not destined for a corporate environment, and this job had me in a trailer by Gorilla World, which I felt was just sort of fitting. And sometimes people would knock on the door and say, "Is this Gorilla World?" I'd go, "Sort of, not quite." But it was quite fun for me. The writing part, I liked writing for the membership magazine because there's a lot of Mary Roach kind of things that go on in a zoo. And that was the zoo kitchen, the people who come up with the recipes for the zoo animals, the guy who's removing the elephant wart, plantar wart with a laser. I mean, that is so up my alley, and I loved all of that. What I didn't do well at was the public relations element of it. Because I had to take calls, I answered the phone, so I would take the calls from the press, and every now and then there'd be somebody following up a rumor. And one at a time, somebody from the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, called and said, "I heard that one of the cheetahs was sucked dry by fleas." And instead of denying this and doing damage control, because it wasn't true, in fact, my response to this reporter was, "Wow, how much blood do you think one flea takes in? And how much blood in a cheetah? How many fleas would that take, and is it possible?" You know, so he's getting very excited, and we're going back, and my boss is like, "What are you doing? Just say it's not true." So public relations, not for me.
Yeah. So it went from there to writing magazine stories, freelancing magazine stories, and then do you want to talk a little bit about the column?
Oh, the column, the Salon.com column. Yes. Yeah, Salon.com. It was the first online magazine. It was very exciting. This is an online magazine. This is 1999. It was a reported column that dealt with human body, medicine, health, but the kind of fringier, Mary Roachier aspects of it. And an agent called me at some point and said, do you have any book length ideas? And I was like, "No, I write things that are 3,000 words long. I have a very short attention span." And he said, and I said, "I don't know, what would I write about?" He said, "Why don't you look at," because this was online, you could look at the hit rates. And he said, "Well, which of your columns had high hit rates?" And I did go and look at that. And in fact, there were three cadaver research, generally related to cadaver research columns that had high hit rates. One was a Thanksgiving Day column about how much does the human stomach hold before it bursts.
Of course.
Yeah.
The classic and Thanksgiving story.
It was a clank, thank you. I thought it was a classic Thanksgiving Day story. And that there was in the 1800s or early 1900s, there had been a cadaver study, which makes no sense. This is bad research, by the way, because you can eat a tremendous amount of food and your body, if you're alive, not if you're dead, if you're alive, you have a helpful reflex to vomit. Your body will, rather than let the stomach burst, you have a reflex to throw up and to empty the stomach, which it's so throwing up, and also farting, by the way. Relieving, otherwise things could burst. So, you know, it's be thankful for those passages. But anyway, the stomach, it made no sense to prop up dead guys at a dining room table, at which the guy did. And so, but that for that reason, I loved him, is that he had actually set up whole, instead of taking a stomach, it's like the whole, two like dead guys. I don't know if he set the table. I don't know if they had napkins around their necks, but he, you know, filled it that way, had them sitting up. I guess posturally, he wanted to be as biofidelic as possible. I don't know, but anyway, that column had a lot of hits, and also one about crash test dummies in the early days in the 60s and how cadavers were used to calibrate those dummies, because the dummies themselves would just measure the force. And no one knew, what will that force do to the sternum? What will it do to the head? What does that mean, that force? So you needed cadavers to figure that out. And so that, and that one also got high hit rates. And so my agent, in his wisdom, said, I don't know, seems like a book about cadavers. And
yes.
To me, seemed like a bad idea.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine the scenario where somebody would go into a bookstore, like look at this table of new releases and all these amazing books, nonfiction books by incredible authors, and go like, oh yeah, this cadaver one, that's what I'm gonna pick. Like, that made no sense to me, but my publisher thought it would sell, so.
So just a last question.
That's what happened.
Before we take your questions, so what's up with the one-word titles? Those one-word titles have worked for you, except for that one.
I don't know. Packing for Mars, we couldn't do it. I mean, if you guys can think of a one-word title, I defy everybody in here. One word that suggests the challenges of putting humans in space long-term, like the space motion sickness and the weirdness of floating around and bone loss and the psychological things, the isolation, confinement. We were stumped. We couldn't think of a single one word, one syllable, snappy thing.
Yeah.
You know, it can't just be space.
Yeah.
No. Nothing. Anyway, but that was very upsetting.
Yeah.
It was very upsetting. And inevitably, that entire book tour, I was asked at some point, there seems to be some mistake with your titles. Packing for four syllables. Yeah, no, it was. So it always sticks in my craw, that title.
So we'd love to take your questions now, and it looks like we're collecting them right now. So just while we're doing our technical stuff, one last one, Mary, is how do you approach your research once you've got an idea that seems roachable?
Yeah.
What has changed? What gets it from idea to book?
A lot of times Packing for Mars, the idea was really just, I had this thing in the back of my head from years ago. I was working on a book, an article for Vogue magazine on osteoporosis, and I called an astronaut because they deal with bone loss. You know, if you float around, you don't need your bones, and they disintegrate a little bit at a time. And I called this guy, and in the conversation, we wandered away from bone loss because there are more interesting things to talk about. And we got to the toilets in space, and he told me about this thing. It was a video toilet for training the astronauts, because you don't really sit down in zero gravity, you dock with the toilet. And it's a small hole, and it's airflow. It's you entrain the material. Anyway, so you got to do it right. You got to get your angle of approach right. And the way that it was done, it's this toilet, and the video camera is pointing up, and it's closed circuit TV, so the view that it is seeing is right there beside you. So you see this portion of your anatomy in a way that you've never seen it before. And they're very quick to tell you, like, this is not a functioning toilet. Somebody once did crap on the camera, and that was bad. But anyway, so I knew that this would be difficult to work into a Vogue magazine piece. I knew I couldn't work that in, so I stashed it in the back of my head, and all these years, I'm like, one day, I will tell that story. So it kind of became the... There's an ad for faucets, Kohler faucets, that used to run a while ago, where this obnoxious couple goes to an architect, and they take this beautiful faucet, and they put it on his desk, and they go, build a house around this. So the video toilet was kind of my faucet, like, build a book around this. So and then there were a couple other faucets that I had from experiences over the years. And then I just thought, I'll just like throw in 10 more faucets, boom, done, book. So that's kind of how that one went.
Okay, so some of your questions, we just wanted to start with this one. What is either the coolest or the grossest thing you've seen?
The coolest or the grossest? Oh, the grossest, I don't even want to share it with you. It has to do with the fact that I am friends with the medical examiner in Alameda County in California, and she made it her career goal to make Mary Roach gag. And she sent me a text one morning, goes, I have a really interesting case. You should come in. And I don't know, we don't need to go into the details, but that was, I mean, I thought I was pretty macho because of the things I'd done for Stiff. Yeah. I'd been around a lot of bodies, but they hadn't been sitting somewhere for a long time in the heat. So so it is possible to make me leave the room gagging. It can be done, ladies and gentlemen.
Someone has asked, in Stiff, you mentioned your desired plan upon your death. Has the research you performed for any of your other books created a life-altering opinion of your own?
A life-altering opinion of?
Of what you wrote about in Stiff, about what you plan to do.
Is there a similar? I think that Gulp was a little bit life-altering. All of them alter me briefly in a kind of horrible, weird way. Like, Bonk, when I was reading Human Sexual Response by Masters and Johnson, which is a really, really thorough description of everything that happens to men and women throughout the sexual response cycle, like things like the earlobes may enlarge and other things engorging. And so if you are reading this book, you start paying attention to that stuff in a really distracting way. You're like, you know, is this the part where, you know, so that was... That was weird and distracting. And similarly, Gulp, the chewing, the oral processing chapter, for a while, I would go to a restaurant and I'd look around at people chewing and they're forming a bolus. And I know what's going on in there. You know what's going on? Intraoral bolus rolling is going on. And I would just look at people and go, my God, we shouldn't do this in public. It's disgusting. Like, we should have sex in public and chew behind closed doors. Yeah, so.
So you didn't answer the question of, in Stiff, you talked about what you wanted to do on your own death, right?
Yes,
your
right.
Your plan. So has it changed at all through your research?
Oh, for that particular?
Yeah.
Have I changed? You know what? I went so far as, because I wrote Stiff, I really have to donate my remains to some university. It would be a little cop-out for the author of Stiff to go get a plot in a cemetery. So I have the forms from the two schools near me, UCSF and Stanford, but I never really, I'm kind of like a high school senior. I don't know, like, where do I want to go? I'm not sure. Like, what is the anatomy? What's the view from the anatomy lab like at Stanford? And I don't know, which facility is the storage? How do you get stored? I don't know. So, it is my intent. It is still my intent.
A great question, by the way. Did sales of Stiff increase after its placement in the HBO TV series 6 Feet Under? And the questioner is asking this that because that's when he first purchased the book, or he or she. Sorry, I can't tell.
Yes, yes, absolutely. That I still, all these years later, some invariably on a book tour, at least 3 or 4 people will say, I heard about your, I didn't hear about it, I saw about it. I saw your book on 6 Feet Under, and that's the first I'd heard of it, or saw of it. Experienced it.
Yeah.
So yes. I don't have any sales figures for what kind of bump that was. But it was great because we didn't know, it wasn't, and people thought it was product placement. Like, my publisher was like, yo, let's buy some space on 6 Feet Under. Like, publishers do that, or could do that. They don't. So it was just Alan Ball, the creator, said, you know, could we use this book on the show? And we all assumed it would just be on a table, like set dressing, but it was actually part of the plot in 3 episodes. And they actually zoom in on it as though it were product placement.
Yeah.
It's like, yes!
That's pretty great.
Yeah. I have a feeling it was a pretty important moment in the history of that book.
Yeah. What subjects are there that you wouldn't explore or research?
Oh, most things don't really lend themselves to my kind of approach. I think a lot of so much of science now, and cutting-edge science is genomes and protein receptors and things that are not bodies on slabs, you know. So a lot of what I'm covering is kind of old-timey science in a way.
Yeah.
So most of it, and that's why I'm here to crowdsource the next book from you fine people here in Salt Lake City.
Perfect. Yeah. That was great. Someone is asking what's being done to prevent PTSD in the military, and then the second part of it, which isn't part of it at all, are there any common themes that have run through your books?
The first question I'll say, you know, PTSD, there are entire books and films, and it's a huge topic, and it's a spotlight topic, and I am, as I say in the book, kind of a goober with a flashlight, so I had planned to write about it if I had embedded with the Chaplain's Corps, which was a plan. My embed was turned down by ISAF, which is the coalition umbrella group, so I wasn't able to do that anyway, so I didn't have a setting for it, and so I cannot tell you an informed answer for that question. The second part was, what was the second?
Are there any common themes that have run through your books, intentionally or otherwise?
Not necessarily intentionally, but they all, I believe all of them, are kind of about the human body in unusual circumstances, dead, in a sex lab, in space, in combat. These are either about the human body. I mean, Gulp is just, you know, a vacation trip down the Alimentary Canal, a journey. They're often about the human experience, but taking it and putting it in a kind of an unusual context. Yeah.
Did studying the science of sex take some of the fun out of it?
And that one, really, yes, that one we've answered.
I really just asked that question to say it out loud, really.
Yeah. That one temporarily. It was distracting.
The earlobes,
and I don't even remember what else. But it was but it was informative. But sometimes you don't necessarily want to know all the little details of what's going on because you should lose yourself in sex, not be like,
Someone asked, where does your financing for travel and research come from?
It comes from my advances. Yeah. That's where it comes from. Yeah. It doesn't work. The model for magazine feature writing, or used to be anyway, that the magazine would reimburse you for travel. But now it is up to you as the author to make sure your advance is going to cover the travel that you need to do, or the translators you need to hire, or the whatever research. I don't hire research assistants because the research is so fun.
Yeah.
I want to do that. But you pay that. That's where that comes from.
Have you ever felt in danger during your research?
In danger? No, I never have. I had apprehension about the prospect of doing an embed because I did want to go out with a chaplain's corps who go out with units and really expose themselves. The chaplain doesn't carry a weapon, but the chaplain's assistant is armed. So he covers the chaplain. And I was like, but who covers Mary? So I had some apprehension about that, but it never happened, so I wasn't scared.
So I wanted to segue now into our crowdsourcing portion of the evening, and I have a whole bunch of ideas here, and I'm reading them for the first time. And just to get started, several came in from readers in advance, and so I wanted to start with this one, who writes very authoritatively, I see the potential for a Roach book about the psychology of driving, how we tolerate deaths from fatal crashes, what happens to bodies in crashes,
yes,
both buckled and unbuckled,
uh-huh,
what happens to families and strangers who become interconnected through deadly crashes. He goes on and on.
You know what? Yeah, you know, I don't know if you're here, Mr. Crash person.
He said he wasn't.
Okay, but yeah. I actually wrote a short proposal. That is really an interesting idea. My agent was like, way too dark, way too much crash.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But yeah. I was like, yeah, I think that's really, really interesting. So instead, I've touched on it in Stiff, I've touched on it in Packing for Mars, the capsule splashdown test, and I've written about it in Grunt. There's a chapter on how do you, you know, build a vehicle that drives over 100-pound bombs. You know, how do you test that? Anyway,
I'm giving extra credit to this Tribune reader for this proposal because he pegged it on the fact that Utah just passed a primary seatbelt law after years and years of resistance from the legislature. So he even had a reason.
Oh, my God. A round of applause for this man. Wow.
The other thing I wanted to suggest, and this is just from Tribune reporting, but we've written a lot about the Utah population database. And it has 8 million people and 22 million health records.
Wow.
Researchers at the University of Utah have discovered two genes, mutations that cause breast and ovarian cancer.
Cool, wow.
So anyway, we'll send you that link if you want.
Because that's wild.
Yeah, which is a really great segue. This wasn't planned. One of you
Isn't she good? She's so good.
One of you suggested a book about large families, and that's one of the things that's... particularly
so it's like,
Utah.
Why would that come up here?
Yeah. But also it's one of the things that fuels this population database and the genetics of diseases that spread through families.
So, right. Yeah. That's a very cool.
So we'll give you the information on that.
Good.
Someone suggested schism, the science behind what divides us, religion, politics, race, species.
You. Yeah.
Thank you, Rachel.
That's a good topic.
And what I'm liking here is in these suggestions, they're doing them in one-word titles.
I know, I like that one. Yeah, schism is good, but it's too it needs just to be skiz. And then the follow-up,
Here's buzz, the science of advertising influence and tricking your brain into buying, I think that word is stuff.
It
doesn't need. Thank you very much.
That's a good one. Advertising is a particular interest of mine. That and if I could get access, better access to the corporate world, and there, but everything's always off limits.
I have a phone number here if you'd like.
Okay,
that,
good. All right, that's a great one. That's a great one.
Shake, the science of secret societies, everyday cults, and the handshakes that will get you into heaven.
That's great. It's great.
We'll tell you more about that later. Medical testing, museums, animal helpers, the pigs who find truffles, police dogs, comfort animals, seeing eye
dogs. Is this one person?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So maybe you could do it from the point of view of these animals.
Challenging.
Pupil, why the family-friendly state underfunds public education.
That's the one. That's it.
I think those are all of our... Oh, wait. This is a great one. Thank you. A historical research on incidences of cannibalism, such as the Donner Party.
Yeah.
Therefore, dead bodies in the digestive system, combining...
Oh! Wow. Yeah. Stiff gulp.
Yeah. And then the second idea from this same person is you could research how foods become regional favorites, which is just an opportunity to mention Utah's funeral potatoes.
What? What's a funeral potato?
Does anyone want to?
And can I have some?
we'll let you know where you could. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. This is a topophilia, the love of place, the science of why some people love a place so much they always come back to it, won't leave, even in extreme conditions. Someone suggests reproductive research, IVF, fertility, birth control, birth defects, and researching habits of animals that take place in the wild. I've heard that baby sea turtles find their moms when they return to the ocean. How does anyone know these things?
I mean, yes. Is that your question or is that written down?
That was included with the pitch. I think that's great.
That's great, yes.
This is another one that comes from very Utah twisted. Are humans wired for religion?
Yeah, I think that isn't the God spot. I mean, there is a book for that.
And on that note, I just want to thank you for a lovely conversation. I want to thank all of you for coming. Thank you so much. And I want to thank both Weller Bookworks, the Public Library, as well as the Tribune for inviting us all together to have this conversation. Mary will be signing books.
And we have a giveaway.
Oh, and she has a giveaway.
Yeah, we have a special incentive here. This is with every purchase. You can have as many of these things as you want because I'm trying to get rid of them. It's the end of the tour, man. This is MRE, combat ration toilet paper, the actual. They're made near where I live, and I ordered the minimum order, which is several thousand of these. My entire basement is full, and I had stickers that say grunt, which I thought worked nicely. So I'm giving these suckers away to anybody who gets online and gets a book, any book, so that's where we are with these little guys.
A truly unique book tour giveaway, I have to say. And isn't it lovely how it all comes back to diarrhea?
It truly does.
Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you.